4 o'clock on Public Radio KCBX, and I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, here with you live for the next hour. After almost 4 years of the Reluctant Therapist discussions going on by myself in the little studio, we're going to bring it live to you to open up the discussion for everyone so we can share our ideas and share our conversation and share what's going on in our personal lives and our very public lives in ways that we don't often get to talk about at home or with each other. So I invite you to call in over the next hour, 805-781-3875, and share what's on your mind. Maybe there's conversations from past Reluctant Therapist shows that you've been burning to talk about and never could get in touch with me. Call in today. We can talk about it. Or maybe you'll want to join in on the conversation that's on my mind today, which is a little bit about why I'm the Reluctant Therapist and why I got into this business and why I'm concerned about the mental, emotional, and relational health of all of us. Originally, my decision to go back to graduate school and study counseling was a desire to kind of understand myself. I had struggled with anxiety as a kid. I had a lot of worries. I wondered if I was normal. I was sure that I was the only person who felt the way I did about everything in my life. I always felt like I was a bit of an outsider or much too emotional or much too caring. So in a desire to understand my own weird self, I decided to go to school and study psychology. I went to Pacifica Graduate Institute in Carpinteria, which opened my world. I studied all the counseling psychology philosophies. I learned about family systems therapy. I understood how communication systems work. And at the end of the 2 years, it was really never my intention to become a licensed professional therapist. I really just wanted to understand how to be a better version of myself. But over the course of my studies, I started to realize that everyone I worked with and everyone who was at school had a lot of the same concerns I did. Am I normal? Am I doing things right? Is my life the way it's supposed to be? Why do I feel sad, anxious, depressed, happy? And is it okay to feel these ways? And so as I started to get into the internship part of my work, I spent 15 years working at the county doing crisis intervention and crisis counseling. And I started to find this pattern with my clients that everyone seemed to have the same concerns, that if I do not feel like I'm normal, where do I fit in this culture? And I also noticed that over the 15 years of doing that work, that people weren't getting better, that they actually would just kind of bounce along at the same level of function or dysfunction. And I was concerned because here I'd been trained to do this work, and yet we really didn't have a great success rate long term. So my concern is that if psychotherapy is where we go to help heal those things about our lives that most concern us, why don't we have a better model for helping people to actually get better? Or maybe really what we need to talk about is not whether or not people aren't getting better, but how do we learn to live with those things about us that aren't quite right? Maybe not considered normal, maybe the things we think are weird. How do we learn to live with, cope, accept, understand those parts of ourselves that are a little off and make the best life possible with those things? I'd love to know what you think about that. You can call in any time over the next hour, 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. You're listening to Issues and Ideas here on Public Radio KCBX, and we're talking about the nature of psychotherapy and the nature of therapy and how we've gotten to where we are. As a marriage and family therapist, I'm charged with caring for the emotional and relational health of my clients. That's what I signed on to do. But what's happened over the course of the last 15, 20, 25 years is that marriage and family therapists have moved away from dealing with the relational health of their clients and being put in a position of dealing with medical diagnosis, dealing with making diagnosis that end up with our clients in many cases being medicated more often than ever before in history. And this medicating trend that we've had in our culture hasn't really brought us to a place of healing. It's actually brought people to a place of feeling less secure, less stable. And that's what concerns me. Because we're pathologizing behaviors in people that at one time were considered normal. People who are grieving the loss of a spouse or a child or a parent are put on antidepressants after 6 weeks if the grieving seems to be taking too long. Isn't grief supposed to take a long time? So my concern today is, how did we lose charge of our power as individuals and hand it over to people that were considered experts at the time? And I think it helps to talk a little bit about the history of psychology in our culture, because there's an assumption that we have this great understanding of human development or human nature, and that we've got to this point in 2012 where we so understand the functioning of the brain and the functioning of individuals that we should be able to fix everything that ails us. But psychology really is a new profession. It's not that old. I mean, we know that Freud and Jung were kind of the fathers of modern psychology, but how did we deal with mental health before Freud and Jung, when people had a difficult time functioning, getting along with their community, maybe hearing voices or feeling depressed or not being able to get out of bed in the morning? What did we do in ancient cultures when people weren't able to fit into the norm of the society? Well, the interesting thing is that when people were out of sorts, they were considered to be out of balance, either out of alignment with the gods or out of alignment with nature, and that the thrust of the work to help people was to help bring them back into alignment with nature or with their gods. And so people were charged with either going out into the wilderness for 2 or 3 days on a walkabout to get back in touch with nature and the earth and to help find their center. Or people were sent to the Parthenon or different gods in the city, and they were to pray and sit with the gods till they found out what it is they'd done to get out of balance and find health again. In some cultures, in Native American cultures, people who were outside of the norm, outside of the mainstream of their culture, were somehow considered deities. If they were able to hear voices outside of the regular person's abilities, they were considered to have more magical powers. But as we came through culture, as we got to Freud and Jung's time, this idea that there was a particular way that humans needed to behave that was okay and understandable became much more narrowly defined. And so what was okay for people in the 1600s, by Freud and Jung's time, that behavior was not okay. And the target that Freud and Jung focused on was hysteria. That was their main focus. And hysteria was particularly a woman's issue. It was considered to be tied to her feminine being, her bodily health. And there's actually a lot of studies that have been done that Freud and Jung were more focused on how to help women be more like men or stop being so dramatic or emotional, and help women to be more like men, more rational and calm and thinking. So Freud and Jung really wanted to take the feminine out of a woman's experience and make her more like a male. Looks like we have our first call on line one. Hi, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
Hi there. It's a set of our listener calling.
Hi.
I believe that KCBX to have a very unique program on, and that's a good topic. I forgot how long you've been in practice. Did you say 4 years?
No. I've been practicing since 1993.
Okay. Over the years, I've done some really good work with anger management. And what I'd like to ask you is, can you suggest a really simple technique for working on anger? And secondly, I forgot my second question.
Well, while you're thinking about it, you said you've done some good work with anger management. Is there a particular program that you are teaching with, or is it something you've gone through?
I went through, yeah, with a very fine MFT here in Santa Barbara.
Fabulous. And did you think of your other question?
No, I haven't.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about anger management, because what I found is that a lot of the mood disorders or emotion disorders, emotions that we feel, the first thing we usually do is stop breathing. Did you find that to be true? And when we hold our breath, we tend to start to lock up our emotions, and that starts to build up the feelings of anger or distress or anxiety or whatever we're feeling at the time. And so being able to find a way to calm yourself through breath is a great first place with anger management, to find that way to connect with yourself. And I'm so glad that you brought it up, caller from Santa Barbara, because One of the things I want to talk about is that we've given away in many respects our power to the experts who are trying to get us more aligned with fitting into normal society instead of focusing in on what are the things we are good at and continuing to do well with those things we excel at. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, please give us a call at 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, your reluctant therapist here on KCBX, and we have another call. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
This is Chris from Lompoc.
Hey, how are you doing, Chris?
Doing well.
And what's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to comment. You asked, how did we get to this place? And I don't know. There was a lot of emphasis in our society on conformity during the 50s. And I know there was a kind of a reaction to that, a pushback. Ken Kesey wrote Cuckoo's Nest. And, you know, there was a hippie movement that was, as Jerry Garcia said, you know, misfit power. So there were people that recognized they were different and banded together. That's all I had to say.
No, thank you for calling. And I think that's a great point because, you know, after Freud and Jung's work, and they focus mostly on women and hysteria and trying to get women to become more like men because men understood their rational way of being, as we moved into the 50s and 60s, you know, the idea of family therapy started to emerge in the late 40s, early 50s through communication work and through social workers who'd gone in and realized that when children were removed from homes and got treatment, when they were returned to their homes, their symptoms would come back right away. And so social workers started noticing a connection between what was going on in the family and the behavior of those people in the family and started to realize, you know, how we interact with each other impacts who we are and how we behave. And so this was the emergence of family therapy at the time. And it kind of coincided with the coming out of the very repressive, oppressive post-World War II idea of conformity. And that people, there was one type of normal and that everyone needed to achieve this one level of normal to be okay. And so early psychology, psychotherapy was really about bringing people into the fold and getting everyone on the same page that if children were misbehaving or families were in trouble, they were considered dysfunctional until we got everyone acting as they should. There was very little tolerance for children who spoke out or people who had divergent thinking or different ideas. And so therapy was very much about bringing people back into line. And this changed in the 60s, of course, with the civil rights movement and the new awakening of different thought processes and opened up therapy in a lot of different ways and fast-tracked us to changing what we believed was true about normal through the 60s. We have another call on line one. So through the 60s, all of a sudden people started to question, you know, what is normal and am I okay just the way I am? And is there room for divergent thinkers? Can we be outside the box and still be okay? And so that was the golden age for psychotherapists at that time because it was very much about individual treatment and our fathers of psychotherapy family systems at that time were Salvador Minuchin and Virginia Satir and Carl Whitaker, who were really about getting to know what was unique about each individual and striving to make each individual the best version of themselves they could be. And in psychology at that point was very individualized and very much about connections and communication and problem solving. We have another call. Hi, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
Hello, I'm Sylvia from Avila Beach.
Hi, Sylvia. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for your show. I when you asked about how therapy has gotten to this point, it occurred to me that there are some parallels with birth and that when, you know, before there was a whole medical establishment, women helped each other.
Yes.
And families helped each other. And then the medical model kind of took over so that women sought care outside of themselves, outside of their families. And birth was more seen as something to be treated. And as mental health problems, it became something that you were medicated for, so that a normal process became abnormal.
Absolutely. Sylvia, thank you so much for bringing that up, because, you know, this idea that we can no longer determine how we can best take care of ourselves has a lot to do with how I feel we've become so disconnected to our core being. And I think birth is a great example that we have pathologized this very normal process, that we've taken it out of the woman's home and into the hospital, and also to the rate of C-sections that we do now.
Yes.
That's got to be a great concern, because we don't talk about the emotional effect it has on women who go in believing they're going to have natural childbirth, and all of a sudden their body's being cut open, they're going through a C-section, and they lose, you know, lots of sense of power or faith in themselves.
Exactly.
So what do you think we need to do?
Well, I think some things that are positive are, I mean, I'm not thinking so much in terms of birth, because I think there has been an enormous effort for women to be trained as midwives and mm-hmm. to normalize birth. I realize, though, that the C-section rate keeps going up. So,
it does.
But the effort, at least, is there. And I think that also with mental health, some of the positive things are, for instance, AA, where people go and help each other, support each other in dealing with a problem that affects a whole family.
Absolutely.
Other than that, I haven't really thought of it farther than that.
Well, I'm glad you called in, Sylvia. I appreciate you joining in the conversation.
Thank you very much.
But I love what Sylvia said, and if you'd like to join in the conversation, please call us at 805-781-3875. I'm the Reluctant Therapist here on KCBX. But Sylvia brings up this great point about normal and pathologizing things that are normal in our life. You know, what determines what is normal for us? Thank you for listening. It's 4:18, and this is Issues and Ideas. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. I'm here until 5 p.m. when we'll go to the news from NPR's All Things Considered. Today, we're talking about the nature of therapy and how did we get from a place of nurturing the individual, of trying to help individuals find what is whole and normal about themselves, to becoming a culture that pathologizes behaviors that are actually a natural part of the life cycle. And who determines what's normal? You know, my concern is one of the things that determines what's normal right now in our culture is the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which is the Bible by which therapists communicate with each other. And this DSM was actually created, it was funded by the government around the time of World War II as a way of determining what soldiers would be the best fit for service in the military. So you can imagine then what were going to be considered normal and acceptable emotions. They wanted people that, you know, responded well to authority, that could take orders, that weren't highly emotional or reactive. You know, they wanted people that had kind of a flat affect about them. And so everyone who was outside of that normal was considered to be abnormal, to be dysfunctional in some way. So the early Diagnostic Statistical Manual, which I can't say, so we'll just say DSM, the early DSMs were really about trying to define what it was to be a great person in our culture. And we're then talking about the late 40s, early 50s, when we were all about kind of conformity. So early pathologies or early disorders were homosexuality. Anything out of the hysteria was considered a DSM, a woman's disease at that time. And so a lot of the early diagnoses that we had in the DSM were, of course, later proven to be not disorders at all, not diseases, but part of our cultural norm. And so as we've moved forward through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and to today, where they're talking about creating the DSM-5, there's a lot of concern and discussion about this book. Shouldn't this DSM be getting smaller? Shouldn't we have a greater range for what is normal in our culture? You know, why do we keep expanding the DSM? Why do we have so many ways that people can be diagnosed as being diseased? I think it has a lot to do with our move away from an individual focus to more of a pharmaceutical focus and this Western medical focus, trying to listen to someone's symptoms, diagnose them with a problem, and set up a common treatment plan. And the minute we moved to that in our profession as psychotherapists is when we lost the ability for individuals to be unique. Looks like we have a call on line one. Nope. Okay. We'll hold on. Thank you. If you call back, the number is 805-781-3875. This is KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, here with you till 5 o'clock. And we're talking about the nature of therapy and a little bit about, you know, how do we determine what is normal in our culture and how did we get to this place where we are not, you know, we're not broadening our definition of normal. We're not broadening and bringing in more opportunities for people to be unique, to express themselves. We are actually making a larger amount of ways that people can be diagnosed as abnormal. So my great concern is that if we continue to find ways to diagnose people as being abnormal, then we get into trouble having any artists, any creative thinkers, any children that can't sit still for more than 20 minutes are now considered sick. And that gets us in trouble. Thank you for joining the program. This is Elizabeth Barrett. Who's this?
This is Brian.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, I had a question on, I apologize, I'm actually...
Sounds like we're in an emergency. Hopefully that's not for you.
No, I'm just on a busy street.
All right, so what...
I actually had a question on, in terms of medications and medicine being prescribed, you know, I'm a early 30s male, and, you know, in about to go down the path of having children, and currently see a lot of children being prescribed medicine to pay attention in class or to get thinner or for a multitude of reasons, and just want to get your opinion on the use of prescriptions and pharmaceuticals in growing adolescents.
So, Brian, thanks so much for calling in about that. I'm going to say goodbye for now, but I'll answer your question off air. This is something I'm extremely passionate about and I have to be really careful with because, you know, pharmaceuticals are a part of our life and a part of my profession. So let me just say that when we look at statistically people using prescriptions, it is thought that 1% of our population is in need of some sort of prescription medication to function well. 1%. We currently prescribe to 14% of our children. So 13% of our children are on medications that we're not really sure are doing any good. And we're not sure at all what the long-term effects are of these medications. So I have a lot of concerns. My concerns are, one is if we blanketly say no meds at all, then the 1% of children who absolutely can't function without them don't get help. But my bigger concern is for the 13% of the children who can't quite sit in their chair for 20 minutes, or, you know, their parents are super busy and they need more discipline, or their diet is laden with different chemicals. You know, my concern with medications is that it stops us from looking at the whole picture. And if we want to be effective helping people, we have to look at the whole picture: mind, body, spirit, culture, environment. You know, what is that child's home life like? Who's watching them? Who's paying attention to their day to day? What do we do about children who, you know, need a different way of learning, who can't sit still? Our public education only can afford to teach one way, but not all children can work that way. So I'm concerned that our long-term effects of the children that are being medicated, once you start on medications, you can't just go off of them. You know, there are long-term effects to your mental health just dropping off meds. And that's not just for children. That's for people who find themselves starting to use antidepressants. If you get yourself involved in an antidepressant, you better be darn sure you have a way of coming off of them at some point, because you can't just stop or your symptoms are much worse. So I have concerns on many levels about the use of pharmaceuticals, but my greatest concern is that we're medicating children when developmentally we have no idea how this impacts them in the long term. We don't know, once we medicate a child, where they would have gone developmentally. They might have outgrown these behaviors, but once we intervene pharmaceutically, we no longer can let that child develop normally. We've now intercepted. So Brian, I appreciate your call. And if you'd like to call in, 805-781-3875. I'm here till 5 o'clock with you. We have another caller on the air. Hi, this is Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
This is Rick in San Luis.
Hey, Rick. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
You were mentioning the 60s before and the individuality that people were getting into. And I was part of that movement. And one of the things I wanted to bring out, which I think gives a perspective on why there's this emphasis on medication today, is that in the 60s, we really rejected the conformity that we've been forced to go through in the 50s. And we rejected a lot of the decisions that were being made at high levels, such as the war in Vietnam.
Yes.
And we sought to find out who we really were. And so we departed from the conformist lifestyle and just began experimenting just to see how we would be under complete freedom. We threw away all the restrictions, and we made our share of mistakes, but what we found more often was that our instincts took us in the right direction, and we ended up finding out what was really fulfilling. We spent a lot of time in nature. We discovered our natural state of being, which was quite different than what the societal state of being was with all of its regimentation. And we found that once we were free and living in nature, life became truly wonderful. And we also changed our diet, so we were eating more natural foods. And as we got away from more artificial ingredients and stuff, we found that our moods, we were much more peaceful. And this went on and developed into various types of natural, like homeopathic and herbal remedies for disease and stuff. And things were getting really good on through the 70s.
Yeah, we were on a roll for quite a long time.
And then there was this big reaction by the establishment.
I know
that sought to discredit everything that we had done.
I agree, and I appreciate your call because you take us on another course that I think is really important at this time. That we really were on a good track in the 60s. We started opening up the ideas of how can we help the individual be more whole, be more helped. But we were sidetracked through the 80s with this idea that there was a better way than the natural, that there was more ease and convenience, that people didn't have to suffer, that we could fix things quickly, and that we lost our focus on, you know, those simple ways, those paths to happiness. And we talked a lot about, you know, what people described as happiness became a huge issue in the 80s. Hi, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
This is Raymond.
Hey, Raymond. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to make a comment about the nature connection, the importance of that for kids and for mental health.
Please do. I'm on that track with you. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, there's an author whose name is Richard Louv who has written a book called The Last Child in the Woods.
One of my favorites. I make my class read it every year.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, and he talks about, you know, nature deficit disorder.
Absolutely. It's the fastest growing disorder we have right now.
Yeah, and it's really kind of more of a perspective about where these other disorders kind of come from.
Exactly.
Yeah, and the other thing I would like to say in addition to that is that I'm part of a community called the Mankind Project, and I sit in a circle with men on a weekly basis, and we support and facilitate one another in our process of moving towards wholeness and self-acceptance.
Is this anything connected to Robert Bly's work and Iron John's work?
Yes, it is. He was one of the early people who was kind of a spokesperson for what they used to refer to as, you know, the men's movement.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you brought that up, Raymond, because we talk a lot about women and, you know, Freud and Jung concentrated in hysteria, and then we went through the feminist movement and women have gotten more empowered. But what we haven't talked about, and you and I should talk, you know, another time to do another Reluctant Therapist, is that we really need to now reinvest our time in empowering our young men, because we're in a huge crisis of young men in their 20s being so lost and not having the same advantages as women in college and in schools, and what that's having, the impact that's having in young men's mental health and their feeling of esteem. And do you, you know, I know you're working maybe with older gentlemen, but I'm feeling that we need a real connection, mentoring between the older generation and the younger generation.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually have, there's another organization that came out of the Mankind Project called Boys to Men.
Yes.
And that organization is works with boys from 12 to 18. And one of the things both these organizations do is they conduct rites of passage.
And I love
for
that.
Young men and for older men, too. And that's something our culture does not have. And as a result, you know, boys in particular are kind of, you know, they don't know what it means to move towards the journey towards manhood.
You know, I agree. Like, so, Raymond, will you please, you know, send me an email so we can talk about this further and maybe get you on the air?
Yeah, okay.
Thanks for calling in. So it's 4:30, and this is Central Coast Radio, KCBX. I'm the Reluctant Therapist, Elizabeth Barrett, with you today on Issues and Ideas. Going to be here till 5 o'clock. Looking forward to your phone calls, 805-781-3875. Funds for this program were provided by Chaucer's Bookstore in Santa Barbara, hosting book signings from a wide variety of writers. For a complete schedule, the website is chaucersbooks.com. Support for KCBX comes from Moran Brothers Automotives, where the safety, reliability, and economy of your car comes first. Appointments at 541-2407. And coming up at 5 o'clock, it's news from NPR's All Things Considered. Today on the program, you'll hear about, in the past couple of years, bullying has become a popular topic. It's everywhere on TV, from the nightly news all the way down to a bully cupcake on the show Cupcake Wars. In fact, people on TV throw the word bully around so much that it's making it difficult to have a real conversation about an actual problem. Eric Deegans of the Tampa Bay Times says there's a mixed message in all of the coverage. It's bad for kids to be bullies at school, but reality TV stars such as Gordon Ramsay get paid a lot of money to be bullies on TV. And that's at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered here on KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist, here with you till 5. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this? Hi there. Oh, did I lose you? All right. So you are listening to The Reluctant Therapist today. We obviously are live for the first time together after almost 4 years of coming to you each month and talking about the state of our mental and emotional health. You can call in with your thoughts and ideas at 805-781-3875. I'd love to talk to you. I'm sure there's a few things you've wanted to say back to me over the last few years, and I'd love to hear from you. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Judith in Arroyo Grande.
Hey, Judith, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm going to go back to the DSM. Is that it? The
Please
Diagnostic
do.
Manual, at any rate.
Yes.
And point out an advantage that you may or may not have mentioned on the program of having a lot of things covered, which is insurance. Because
yes.
Until we have universal health care coverage, everything is determined by the insurance company, and if there isn't a diagnosis to cover you, you are out in the cold, and you won't get any counseling or psychological treatment.
Exactly.
So in some ways, it's an advantage that a doctor or a psychologist can find a category to put you under.
And, you know, I agree with that, and it's, to me, one of the catch-22s of the whole issue right now, because once you're diagnosed with something, that label starts to become the story you tell about yourself, right?
I totally agree, because I have a label that was pretty devastating at
yes.
the time, even though my therapist assured me on a scale of 1 to 10, I was back at about 2.
Right.
But it took me a while to get over the label, so I agree with you on the label. So I don't know what the answer is, as long as our insurance system works the way it does.
Absolutely, Judith. Thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
And, you know, Judith brings up such a great point because, again, nothing is without intended or unintended consequences. People need to get help. People are struggling and suffering. I'm aware of that. People feel anxiety, depression. You know, we have a hard time concentrating. You have a hard time getting over losses. Our life is about ups and downs. The human journey is about times of great joy and times of great grief. And the question is, on this journey, how do we best support ourselves? How do we best get help when we need help? And one of the things that we've found ourselves in through the 80s is that therapy, as it grew and matured through the 60s and 70s and into the 80s, wanted to become more accepted as a scientific practice. And so therapists linked themselves up to the whole insurance industry, and that became kind of the sword that we took to get more recognition. Was once we were linked to the insurance companies then got to start determining how we treat our patients, how we best treat our clients. And that's how we found ourselves in this medical model. Instead of looking at individuals and their lives and how their lives were working for them, we started looking as individuals as sick and trying to fix them with a blanket treatment plan that the insurance company determined. So that's when we got into trouble. Hi, you're on the air with a reluctant therapist. Who's this?
Hi, this is Alicia, and I live in North San Luis Obispo County.
Hi, Alicia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to thank you for, I guess, clarifying that we sometimes give our own power away to, like, therapists or people who diagnose and label things.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing some work with nonviolent communication. I don't know if you've ever heard of that. It's something Marshall Rosenberg had developed.
It's not something I'm familiar with, no.
Well, one of the things he talks about is, well, first of all, there's so much new information, like with Brené Brown, about the importance of being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And how people are meant to connect, that
yes.
We're like hardwired to connect because
yes.
That's how we grow and develop.
Yes, absolutely. You've touched on, to me, where we need to go in order to start healing our communities and getting away from this medical model of diagnosis, because what we've lost in our search for medical help or medical treatment, I mean, we have this belief in our community that if it has MD behind it, and I'm not trying to put down the medical profession at all, so let's not go there, but in our desire to get better, to feel better, we've wanted to trust that there are people who know better than we do on how to take care of ourselves. And what we've given up is that the core of ourselves, we are social beings, we are connected beings, and that we find our highest mental health when we are in relations with others. That's why talk therapy was so hopeful at the beginning with Mnuchin and Whitaker and Virginia Satir and a lot of the current clinicians who are doing great talk therapy, is that when people could be witnessed by another person, when another person would hear your story and witness your life, you could start feeling better about who you are, accepting who you are, and finding new ways to cope with your life that would be healing. And that's what we lost when we started diving into insurance companies determining how we did psychotherapy. Thank you for your call.
Oh, thank you for sharing that.
All right. Have a great day.
All right.
Hi, you're on the air with a reluctant therapist. Who's this?
Hi, this is Kyle from Arroyo Grande.
Hey, Kyle. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
I was just wondering, you know, you've talked about how, you know, our current therapy culture often, you know, prescribes and squelches individuality and
yes.
whatnot.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you, as a therapist, personally, what you do to avoid, you know, falling into that trap.
Thanks for calling and asking that question, Kyle. Thanks for asking me what I do. You know, it's interesting because part of what I do is linked to where I went to school. And that's something you all need to understand when you're starting to look for mental health care from a clinician, because there are great clinicians out there. There are people doing wonderful work. So please know that if you do your homework, you can find people that will really sit with you and hear your story and help you come to a place of wholeness. The school I went to, Pacifica Graduate Institute, was really about the basic idea that all of us as individuals are whole. and that it's our culture or our lifestyle or our society that's off. And that we get into trouble when we try to put ourselves into a culture or lifestyle that isn't healthy for us. Because each of us have different temperaments. Each of us have different abilities and things that we do well. Some of us can work in high stress, intense, monotonous work and do well. Some people need to have more freedom and creativity. You know, our job as individuals is to find a way to create our life in such a way that we can best live, that we can best function. We need to take charge of our functionality. And we all have different levels of functionality. So the work that I do is not this simple, but the basic idea is that we all carry baggage in our life. We all have things that throw us off, whether something from our childhood or some grief that we experience or some trauma we experience. We all carry baggage. And the idea was that we somehow would get rid of our baggage and be fixed, but that's not true. I really believe that we carry this baggage in our life, and what a great therapist will do, or a helpful therapist, is sit with you and look inside that suitcase, that baggage of stuff you carry around, and help you understand it and come to peace with it in such a way, and then repack that suitcase so that it's easier to carry. So we never really get rid of our baggage, but we find ways that we can somehow carry it with us in our lives. And in my work, I feel that my job is to witness my client's story, to hear their story, and then tell them what I hear about them in such a way that they're able to rewrite the story they tell about themselves and live a different lifestyle. So to put it in another way, we are really a culmination of the stories we tell. Our culture is really just a series of stories that we tell. The United States is a series of stories we tell about being a superpower and the greatest nation on earth and a melting pot. We are that nation because that's the story we tell. So when you talk about an individual, someone who says, I am depressed, I'm anxious, I'm a loser, I'm sad, you know, when you start to tell those stories about ourselves, that starts to become our reality. And this was the idea that family systems therapy had back in the 40s and 50s. And we kind of lost our way because there wasn't a way to really measure if family systems' idea of this narrative of changing our story really would heal us. But magically, through the course of the 90s, which we call the decade of brain work, where we started looking at the functioning of the brain and how that impacted individuals' mental health, we started to find out, lo and behold, that the brain actually responded to connections in ways that healed it, that the brain cells would change, the neurons would change, that the brain would function differently, start firing off different messages when we were in connections, when we felt good about ourselves, when we were related to other people. So this idea that sitting with someone, telling your story, and then retelling your story in such a way that it's healthy and supportive of who you are actually is healing to not only your emotional well-being, but to your physical well-being, that your brain actually starts to develop different neurons and healthier pathways when someone witnesses your story and you start telling it differently. Hi, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
Charlie.
Hey, Charlie.
Me again.
Well, what's going on? What's on your mind?
Okay. I just wanted to throw in a few thoughts.
Welcome me live, though, Charlie. Say, hey, we're glad you're live, Elizabeth Barrett.
You got it. Who am I speaking with?
This would be Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist.
You're not quite there yet. Okay, I'm ready.
Let me go. Start talking, Charlie.
Okay, am I on?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay. It's hard to tell. Yeah, Charlie. Yeah, I was just hearing some interviews and discussions of some of the things. There's a book, The Other Side of Normal, by Jordan Smoller, looking at responses of different part of the brain for different situations, and the idea that things like anxiety are really part of our normal. Adaptive responses.
Exactly. And if we didn't have them, we wouldn't know when to run. Yeah.
Become dysfunctional. The other interesting book that I heard about, about outsourcing your life. Things become commercialized or commodified. You know that you need to do for a service.
Yes.
Yeah, about people are outsourcing. We outsource so many things. Let's just look at what we can do. It's kind of one step from your what you're talking about is self-care, but really looking in. And I think the other thing I've noticed is psychotherapy is looking at the internal social milieu rather than focusing on the individual as Freud and traditional therapy. Anyway.
Thank you, Charlie. I love all those thoughts.
It's good hearing you. I've been a great fan of your programs, particularly about your thing about bullying, how you know, it's not just school, the thing, and the politicians.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way you gradually expand your focus.
Charlie, thanks so much for calling in and enjoy your day. And it's timely, too, that we talk about bullying going into the election season because we see how it's difficult to teach our children not to bully each other and to be fair on the playground. And then you turn on the evening news and all we see is inter-party bullying that Charlie brought up. So thanks for calling in. If you'd like to call in and be part of the conversation with a reluctant therapist, our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, here for Issues and Ideas. Right about 4:45, coming up at 5 o'clock, we'll be hearing from NPR's All Things Considered. And today on the program, they'll be talking about one of California's two nuclear power plants that's been closed since the discovery of a radioactive leak in late January. With the summer approaching and an increased energy use with it, the state is bracing for the possibility of rolling blackouts in San Diego, Los Angeles, and Orange County. LA Times reporter Abby Sewells talks with Melissa Block about what's being done to stave off an energy calamity, and that's today at 5 o'clock on All Things Considered here on KCBX. But until 5 o'clock, you've got me here, the reluctant therapist Elizabeth Barrett. I'd love to hear from you at 781-3875. We're talking about the nature of therapy and what is normal, and how did we get so far away from embracing the individual and creating a life that suits the individual instead of trying to strip our individuals down to fit into our crazy life? Because what we don't talk about enough is our cultural lifestyle. You know, what changed from the 60s where we started to emerge into this idea of natural foods and meditation and simpler lifestyles. And then we threw it all away and grasped onto this idea that happiness was our greatest accomplishment. And to get happiness, we need to have a lot of stuff. And, you know, that's a whole nother hour. We talk about this idea of stuff and filling our lives with the pursuit of stuff and how we got so far away from those simple things that make us feel whole and healthy that we actually got more ill. Hi, you're on the air with a reluctant therapist. Who's this?
Hi, this is Liz from Arroyo Grande.
Hey, Liz. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to talk again about antidepressants.
Yes.
It seems like so many people I know have been prescribed antidepressants. And even just recently, my kids were telling me about friends that of theirs that are in therapy for their parents' divorce and have been prescribed antidepressants.
Mm-hmm.
I have some elderly relatives that have had medical problems, and one of the first things they're prescribed is antidepressants. And it does seem like a nice shortcut. You know, if you don't know the downsides, it's like a buffer between you and real life.
Yes.
And so could you go more into what the downsides are of taking this kind of easy fix?
Yes, thanks for calling in, Liz. So one of the concerns about antidepressants as a quick fix is twofold. One is that we start pathologizing those parts of our lives that are normal. It's normal to feel depressed and sad and anxious when you lose a loved one or you suffer a loss or a trauma or that you're unsure. It's a normal part of our life to feel those feelings. Yes, we don't want it to go on chronically for years on end, but you can go 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, feeling pretty dark and blue about life. And that's where talk therapy had a ton of success when it first started working with clients talking about anxiety and depression, that there was a great success rate for people to just be heard and witnessed. And with that kind of witnessing of their experience, this natural depressed feelings we might feel would lift over a normal period of time. But we do want a shortcut because we have a very low tolerance for feeling poorly. And the reason we have a low tolerance is because of the media messages we get constantly that we should never feel bad, that if you feel bad for more than a minute, 5 minutes, you should buy something or go somewhere or charge it or take a pill. The problem is we'd never talk about the downside of taking antidepressants for normal issues. Because coming off of the antidepressants, your body chemistry now is altered in such a way that you may feel more depressed and sad than you did before you ever started taking the antidepressant. And that's kind of the dark side of this whole mood disorder movement of medicating normal issues, is that then we're stuck, or people are stuck, with their body chemistry being altered because of the antidepressants or anti-anxiety medication, that coming off of them becomes more difficult to deal with than ever before. So that's really what we need to talk about, is what are the long-term effects? If you're going to start taking an antidepressant, what are you talking about? You know, if you take it for a month, and then you go off it, are you willing to spend 2 months feeling more depressed? You know, that short fix doesn't always transfer. And the other thing we need to talk about is people who've been taking antidepressants for a long term, they stop being effective, and then where do we go? Hi, you're on the air with a reluctant therapist. Who's this?
Hi, it's Summer from Santa Margarita.
Hey, Summer, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Thank you. I would like for you to please repeat the name of that book, Nature's Deficit Disorder, and the author.
I think it's Last Child in the Woods.
Last, okay.
And I'm sorry that I know the author's name has. We'll try to find the author's name for you, because it is one of my favorite books. And I teach family psychology up at Cal Poly, and I do assign it every quarter, because the thing about the book that I love so is that it deals with this idea that children don't need interventions through therapy or psychotherapy or medications. Children need to get outside and play in the dirt. Children need to get in touch with nature and climbing trees. Because one of the concerns we have is that children are afraid of the outdoors now. You know, they're watching Shark Week, and now they're afraid to go in the ocean because they're going to get eaten by a shark, or they'll see anacondas on television, and they don't want to take a hike up a trail because they're afraid of snakes. So children being afraid of nature separates them from their own core being and helps set up anxiety, depression, ADD in children. You know, being out in nature calms us. So I'll try to find the author for you. Thanks for calling in. You're on the air with a reluctant therapist. Who's this?
I was just going to give the author of that Last Child in the Woods.
Please tell us the author.
It's Richard Louv.
Could you spell it?
L-O-U-V.
L-O-U-V. Richard Louv. Thank you so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
So if you'd like to get on the air and speak with us today, the number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the reluctant therapist. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Dave in Arroyo Grande.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for calling in.
Love your show. It's great to hear. Congratulations. We're having some good dialogue.
Oh, thanks so much. I'm actually so excited and nervous I can barely sit still.
Well, I was calling you because I think, you know, what we're hearing are similar vein of things that we're hearing in the discussion about children and the nature deficit. It also holds true, I think, with how adults have become so entwined with being quote-unquote normal or keeping up with the Joneses, but with the advent of cell phones and texting and everything else that we see now in the immediate, there's very little time for cognitive, you know, distance to think about things and actually experience some things before you can make some quick assumption.
Gosh, you're so right.
You know, just taking hikes.
Mm-hmm.
And or I think back to, you know, younger days when you take a 30-mile backpack journey and the blisters you get on your feet and the agony, but you're alone with your thoughts as you're hiking that trail, and so you're able to actually think about some things in pretty heavy depth. So I just think adults as well as kids can just have so much more spiritual strength by taking advantage of the nature that we have around us.
You know, I agree, and I'm so glad that you called in and brought that up, because we underestimate the power of our thoughts. And I think one of the things that's happened, an unintended consequence of our texting, Skyping, constant communication era that our kids are experiencing, is that they're almost afraid to be alone with their thoughts. You know, I've challenged my students at Cal Poly to go 24 hours without being Facebooking or texting, and the anxiety they experience is incredible, and they talk about that. Last year when they had the rolling blackouts in San Diego, some students who live in San Diego came up and said it was their families drove out of San Diego County, not for fear of their life, but because they were freaked out they didn't have Wi-Fi access. And this was the parents and the children. So you're right. I think we need to stop fearing our thoughts.
Yeah, I think that's very much true. So anything we can do to sit down and be quiet and calm, or get out and exercise and be alone with your thoughts, just the comfort of doing some actual thinking instead of, you know, adopting somebody else's thinking as your own.
Thank you for calling in.
Uh-huh.
Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Peyton.
Hey,
from
Peyton.
Shell Beach.
Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
You know, I'm a Cal Poly student myself, and so one of the things that I think is one of the major problems in the mental health right now is that our connections with the rest of society and nature are a little askew in the way that our society looks at nature as sort of something to exploit.
Yes.
And our society looks at people, you know, as something to exploit.
Wow, that's a great connection. And it's true, you know, it's a bit of our religious dogma from our founding part of our culture was that the idea was the earth was given to us by God to use all of the riches. And that mindset itself set us on this course in many ways of exploiting nature to the extent that we have. Am I on the same track with you?
Yeah, I think in the Christian sense it is. But I don't think all societies have dealt with things that way, where
no.
Being a steward of the land and of nature, and one who looks out for the rest of society and all the individuals within it, I think if people give more to these things, you know, it'll make that individual stronger and have a more of a sense of stability.
Yes.
And a place of belonging, which I think that's really important in mental health.
You hit it the nail on the head, Peyton. Thanks for calling in. That's so true. You know, people want to feel connected. They want to feel like they belong. They want to understand where their place is in the world. And we understand our place in our connections with those we love, in our connections with the earth around us. And if we devote ourselves to being stewards of the planet, we feel like there's a reason for us to get up every morning. You know, a lot of the ideas about the feelings of depression we have in our culture is this sense of being isolated from not only ourselves, but from the world itself. Hi, you're on the air with the Reluctant Therapist. Who's this?
This is Jim from Santa Barbara.
Hey, Jim, thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Well, it's the thing about, I think a lot of people are on these devices all the time and even watch too much TV because they're afraid of being alone.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah, like I personally watch way too much TV and I just realize over time it's when I don't have it on or doing something, I don't feel connected with the world. And even though I grew up with a big family and everything and there's people I know, I just don't feel too much alone if that voices aren't out on the radio or TV, you know?
And I think you bring up a good point because they've done a lot of studies about the radio and how it has a great positive impact on our mental and emotional health, that having those voices, you know, kind of coming out to us over the airwaves is soothing and calming and makes us feel connected. And that having the TV on, kind of feeling like you're part of what's happening in the world, can give us a sense of belonging. But then there's that fine line of, you know, losing yourself in the television or the computer where you stop moving, you know, out into the world. And that's when we get into trouble. So there is that fine line. Thanks so much for calling in. So we're at 4:58, and that's going to be issues and ideas for today. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, the Reluctant Therapist. I've had such a great time in the last hour. I appreciate all of you who've called in. I look forward to doing this again, talking about life and therapy and the nature of being a human on this planet. Next week on the program, Andy Harp visits with Festival Mosaic music director Scott Yu, and Brian Reynolds talks with some folks about implementing No Place for Hate projects in our local schools to prevent bullying. I'll be back with you again in August. Thanks for listening and be well.